So I think this is on. So yes, so
I'd like to tell you a little bit about cosmology today. Essentially, this is obviously it's a little bit, it's not about teaching here. I want to give you a sort of update on what we know about the universe, essentially, what we've learned in the last 20, 30 years. And the thing is that we've learned quite a lot. And I know that as a student, and I know a lot of students, often they're drawn into physics by looking at the universe, by looking at, you know, galaxies and stars, and or by, you know, watching Star Trek. I know that, I mean, if I ask my colleagues here, 50% of them will say they went into physics because of Star Trek. You know, it's really a big draw, and it's always been a big draw for me to do cosmology. When I was an undergrad, I wanted to do astrophysics because I wanted to go to Hawaii and to go to the top of Mauna Kea and see these telescopes. Now, that didn't happen, as you'll see in this talk. It turns out that the most fun place I got to go is 2 kilometers underground, which is actually really fun, and I'll get to that. And it's interestingly, this is where 2 kilometers underground is where now our telescopes are now put, because we're looking at different things. Right, I like to talk about cosmology, and I want to do it. There's a lot to say about the universe. Obviously, it's big. There's a lot of things going on. So I'm going to be somewhat specific, and I'm going to take one type of object in particular, and the one I'm going to look at is the biggest thing we've seen. And by object, I mean something that holds together enough that I can throw it. It means it's a gravitationally bound object. Okay, so it's a bound object, like the solar system is bound, like the galaxy is a bound object. So I want to look at the biggest things in the world, in the universe. And then I just want to take a really sort of more layman approach here. Just look at it like if we've seen it for the first time. Ask, okay, what is it? How can we figure out what it's made of? What does it do? What's its goal in life? Whatever. What is the thing? And then try to go backward and then figure out what kind of history of the universe, what kind of physics do we need to do in order to explain why these big objects are there. And yeah, and this is so just discussion. Please interrupt me whenever if you have any questions. And like I want to say again, the cosmology has been a booming science because of data. And so now there's a lot of things about cosmology which are facts, essentially. They're really like we know the age of the Earth. Well, now we're really getting to a point where we know the age of the universe very well. And a lot of things like that. So it's fun to spread the good news, spread the message. All right, so we're going to start by observing. Cosmology, we observe things. We don't actually do experiments, which is unusual for physics. So we just look at the sky. And it turns out that we still can do good science because we see a lot of different things. So we have good statistics. So we can do good science. So we're going to observe. And we're going to observe in 3 different ways. And we're going to observe all with the electromagnetic wave. Okay, we're just light, essentially. But we're going to look at different wavelengths. And I mean, we do more than just looking at the electromagnetic wave. But light is still the best way we have to study the universe. So this is Hubble telescope, one of our nicest. So we're going to start with this, with visible light, which is what the Hubble does. So this is a great telescope. Of course, we have tons of images from this guy. And we learn a lot about the universe. I'm not sure it's the only telescope of this size in the sky. Some of my astronomer friends tell me that probably there must be some other telescopes just like this one, maybe own secret telescopes pointing downward instead of upward. But this one is pointing up, and it's big, and it sees very far. So it's a very nice telescope. So let's see what we see. So this is what you see when you look with your eyes. This is what Hubble sees. And this is one of the biggest objects that I'm talking about. So this is Abel 370. It's a The object is the whole thing. This is what this sort of big blob here. And mostly what you see, each point is a galaxy. I don't think there's any stars here. Everything is a galaxy. And there's a particularly big one here. This is in the center. And so this object, we call those galaxy clusters. And as far as we know, they're the biggest thing in the universe that are gravitationally bound. There's a lot of things going on in this picture. We'll come back to it later. This is not some kind of lensing event. This is a galaxy that must have had a collision, so it has a really long tail. This is an amazing picture. This is what Hubble, and these are not, these visible lights, this is not fake colors. Well, maybe a bit, but not, anyway. I don't know what they did. Maybe they did some photoshopping a little bit on the color, but otherwise it's the true thing, okay? All right, so this is one example. This is Abel 370. They're not all that nice looking. This is another one. It's the X blah, blah, blah cluster. So I'm going to call it just the X cluster. This is what it looks like in the visible spectrum. And it's right here. Okay, so you can't really tell anything. But again, it's a large class of galaxies. So the distances, just to give you a scale here, the distances is, we use parsec in astronomy. So this is 5 megaparsec. So a parsec, it's the distance of a star. When we go around the sun, there's a parallax. The stars are moving a little bit. When it moves by 1 arc second, that's 1 parsec. We define the distance as 1 parsec. So this is 5 megaparsec. If you can just put it in kilometers, 10 to the 20. So yeah, so these guys are about, 5 megaparsecs. And size. And what are they? Yes, I already tell you. So these are galaxy clusters. Briefly, what we see that there are a bunch of galaxies that are held together. There's maybe 10 to 100,000 galaxies in each clusters. Each galaxy itself is much smaller. The galaxies are in kiloparsec. There's many different galaxies. So there's a range of galaxies. But the point is that each galaxy is roughly about kiloparsec. They roughly have 100 billion sun. So that's they have the masses 10 to the 11 solar masses, and there's about this number of galaxies in each galaxy cluster. Okay, so this is just we see this using our Hubble, and there's a lot of these things, and they're absolutely beautiful, but the question is, where are they really? So in order to the first thing we do when we look at this, first of all, we see the thing probably everybody know now that everything and all these galaxy clusters are all redshifted. They're all going away from us. All the lines and the spectrums are shifted to the red. So this is a Doppler effect. They're all moving. It looks like they're all moving away from us. And so we define the redshift by looking at the observed wavelength, for example, for some emission line for hydrogen. And we see that instead of being where it is on planet Earth, it's actually shifted to the red. Okay, so everything is redshifted. And this redshift is due to the expansion of the universe. Okay, so these galaxy clusters are telling us, like everything else, that the universe is expanding and everybody is going away from each other. Okay. There's also a peculiar motion. It's not just a redshift. These galaxy clusters are moving, just like galaxies are moving. So it could be that if there are some objects that are really close to us that actually look blue. That's just because, the universe is expanding, so they're moving away from us, but they happen to be also having a random velocity towards us. And that could be more important than the expansion. But in general, if you look in the universe, everything is red. Everything is going away from us. Okay, everything is shifted to the red. So in particular, this cluster X, for example, has a redshift of 1.4, which is pretty far. But there, yeah. And like I said, actually you can calculate that if the redshift of an object is greater than 0.1, then there's nothing blue that looks blue with a redshift of 0.1. Whenever you're that far away, the expansion always dominates over the peculiar velocities. So this is this X cluster is at 0.4. So it turns out that actually this is really close by compared to many things. We see galaxies all the way to redshift of 7, and which if you convert that in years, so redshift is something we measure. So this is something I can say to you, like redshift of 7 is redshift of 7. This is just something we measure. We just look at how much the thing is, we just calculate the wavelength and calculate the redshift. There's no assumption here. But then often what people do is they convert redshift into age. So redshift of 7, for example, people will say is 770 million years after the Big Bang, or 12.9. So the age of the universe, so this assumes a model, but the age of the universe in this model is 13.7 billion years old. And so this galaxies are like 12.9 billion years. It took 13 billion years for the light to reach us. But this assumes a model. Redshift doesn't. So in the model I'll be describing here is this Lambda CDM. So this is what we'll discover, and I'll try to explain why we believe this is now the standard model of cosmology. This Lambda CDM model. But the point is that whenever I say something in the top which assumes this model, I put a little stamp. Okay? So that means that when I said this is only true for Lambda CDM. And this is the theory we're going to test. And so I'll describe it. So the redshift of 7, this is a true statement. This is a measure experimental fact. The fact that this is this number of years is this model for the universe. Okay. There's a fun fact which is really that redshift of greater than 1.4, galaxy clusters and galaxies are going away from us faster than the speed of light. This expansion in the universe, it's really the space-time which is expanding, so local velocities are all less than light, but things are really going away from us really fast. It's relative velocity, but it can be very, very fast. All right, so yeah, so it turns out that we don't see galaxy clusters far in the past. We see galaxies, but we don't see galaxy clusters. This X cluster is the farthest clusters we've ever seen, and it's at a redshift of 1.4. So these guys are relatively recent objects. Galaxy clusters were created recently. So that's a puzzle. We have to understand that. Why were they created recently? Why were they not there from the very beginning? So that's one question. Then another thing we can look at is look at the galaxies themselves inside of the cluster. We can look at, try to, for example, to measure what their velocities are. So the cluster is one object. By looking at the difference, the tiny difference in redshift between each of the galaxies, we can figure out how fast they're moving. And this is the speed we get, roughly, 800 to 1,000 kilometers per second. So this is how fast these galaxies are moving inside the cluster. And this speed is too high. And you can, for if you can just do a very simple thing here, you do Newton's law here. Just say kinetic energy is equal to gravitational energy. Then you can figure out what the escape velocity is. Right, so you have the escape velocity here, and you just say, well, simple problem. I have 1,000 galaxies, say, with this mass. I know what the size of the clusters are. G here is Newton's constant. So I can just, then I know what the mass is, I know what the distance is, I know what Newton's constant is, so I can calculate the escape velocity for these clusters. And if you do just put these numbers in there, you get the escape velocity is 300 kilometers per second. So the first thing we note when we look at these clusters is that it doesn't make sense for them to be bound object. It doesn't, you know. So there's something wrong in this calculation here. And this is one of our first puzzle. And there's either two explanations, is that we're missing mass, which is the sort of guess we'll make, or also maybe the formula is wrong. Essentially, this is such a simple equation that either R is wrong, M is wrong, G is wrong, or maybe 2 is wrong, or the square root is wrong. Okay. No, but two actually, a lot of people want to modify the 2. And this is because that just means the equation is wrong. Maybe it's not a square root. Square root is sort of has to be because of dimension. But maybe it is. Maybe there's a correction to Newton's law. That would be a correction to the 2. Maybe Newton's law is different. So maybe, yeah, our formula could be wrong. Or maybe the Newton's constant, which we measure here on the planet, is not the same over there. So maybe Newton's constant is not constant. Maybe it varies across the universe. So we are studying every single one of those 4 things that could be wrong and try to explain, because right now this formula is not working. And it turns out that also it's good. You say, well, first of all, you should have been using general relativity, not Newton's. But that's not going to fix it, because it's a very small correction. Just like the escape velocity on planet Earth, you can use Newton's law, and you're not making any mistake. So we're not wrong by a small percentage here. We're wrong by a factor of 3, which is significant. So let's get it right. So first of all, the obvious thing is to look at different things. We see maybe we're missing mass, so let's just look at different things. We have 2 satellites, which are really nice. XMM Newton, which is an ESA, a European Space Agency project, satellite in this case, and then NASA has the Chandra. These guys are looking for X-rays. And if you look at in the X-rays, you see something that Hubble did not see. And for example, this X cluster in particular, now you really see, it was hard to tell before there was anything there, but now if you look at X-ray, you really see that there is a clump of stuff here. Okay. So this is what you see in X-rays. In fact, this guy, the X cluster, was discovered first by looking at X-ray, and it was discovered by another satellite, XMM Newton here, and this is where the name comes from. So what is this X-rays? Well, we think the X-rays, we have good evidence for that, is just coming from some intergalactic gas. So there's some gas in between the galaxies. And it's super hot. It's kind of strange because this is deep space, but still, it's super hot. We're talking about temperature of 10 to the 7, 10 to the 8 Kelvin, so about the same in Celsius. So Yeah, it's super hot. It will not warm you if you were there because it's a very thin gas. You don't get hit very often by particles, but it's still really, really hot. Okay, and indeed, then you can calculate the mass of this gas, and it's twice the mass of the galaxy. So there's a much more gas, twice as much gas as there are galaxies. But still, it doesn't work because a factor of 2 is not enough. Because if you multiply this by a factor of 2 and then you take the square root, that's, you know, it doesn't give you a factor of 3 out. It gives you 1 point whatever. So that's not enough. So we have to do something else, and this is off, you know, where we get to dark matter. So if we can figure out the mass of the whole thing by just saying the gas is in the hydrostatic equilibrium. So it's just like the sun. We look at the sun, the sun is a big plasma ball, and we say, well, it's in equilibrium. Its own gravity is compensating for the heat. So if it's in equilibrium, then you can just calculate what the mass of the sun just by doing hydrostatic. And so you can use that to calculate the total mass, and what you find is that the galaxies and the gas only make up for 15%, and they must be an 85%, which we don't know. And so we call it dark matter. This is an artistic representation of dark matter. Yeah, and great, so we can see it and we don't know what it is. It's also needed for galaxies, which is often how you hear people introducing it. I prefer the simple, just because here the equation was so, you know, escape velocity and it's clear it doesn't work. So that's a nice way to introduce dark matter, but there's also need to be dark matter in the galaxies. We are still missing mass there too. So we're going to want to know what this is and what is dark matter. So there's a lot of hypotheses. There is a lot. I should say, by the way, again, there's also the other possibility that the formula was wrong. I think now there's a lot of evidence that this cannot be at least the whole answer. Modifying gravity cannot explain for other data, and it'll become clearer when I present other things later on in the talk. But so it looks like dark matter is really there. We really need to figure out what it is, and there's a lot of ongoing experiment, and I think with good confidence I could say that a lot of hypotheses we have will be tested in the next 10. They are currently being tested. And so I wouldn't be surprised in 10 years, maybe 15 or maybe earlier, there'll be a New York Times or a Global Mail, you know, we know what dark matter is. Like, you know, it's really in progress. It's going on right now. It's a very active field. In particular, Snow Lab in Sudbury is looking for it. They have big tank of water. So Snow Lab is this mine in Sudbury, 2 kilometers down, which is, you can guess, the place I got to visit. And they're doing the dark matter there, and they're looking for it. So. And what they're looking for is that, well, we don't really know what dark matter is, but the serious contender is that it's a weakly interacting massive particle that's just all around us, very much like the neutrino. In fact, the story is completely similar to neutrino physics. Back in the 30s, they were missing mass. They were missing energy. They were doing radioactivity, and they were missing some mass. And so they say, well, maybe it's just a particle we don't know, and that doesn't interact. And they called it the neutrino, and later on, turned out they were right. So we're exactly in the same situation now. We're missing mass. Say, well, maybe it's a particle we don't know that's weakly interacting. So this is what dark matter is about, and people are all excited to discover it soon, hopefully figure out what it is. Questions? Please interrupt or anything. So the neutrino could have been a great dark matter candidate, because the neutrino, it's weakly interacting, it's just not very massive. If it was a little more massive, it could do the job. So the neutrino actually probably does contribute a little bit. There's a lot of neutrinos in the galaxy. There's a lot more neutrinos in this room than photons. The neutrinos, there's like tons of neutrinos in the universe. And they do contribute to the mass. So part of the galaxy cluster mass is coming from the neutrino, but it's not enough. So we know exactly all the properties of the neutrino, so we can calculate how much does it contribute to the mass of each galaxies, and it's not enough. So we need one more particle. But it would have been great if the neutrino would have done it, then we wouldn't have had to add anything else, obviously. But okay, so yeah, so indeed, that was my nice trip, because I presented this talk, actually Richard is right here, presented this talk a couple of years ago, and I was saying, oh man, it's such a shame that I never got to visit Snow Lab. And well, PI, organized. And this node app is amazing. Okay, you go to a mine 2 kilometers down, which is super dirty. You get all these things, and then you go to a clean room. You get to the shower and everything, and then you are in the super clean room, the deepest clean room in the world. Super huge. It's amazing. I mean, it's a very great lab. All right. And hopefully, and they did a great discovery there, by the way. They were the first to confirm oscillation of neutrino, that neutrino oscillate between each other. So it's a great lab. It's in Ontario, so it's always good to publicize it. And they do great physics there. All right, so the third way we're going to observe is, again, with visible light, but this time let's do something different. We're going to look at lensing. Okay, and this is the last piece, and then after that, we'll know everything we need to know about these guys. I need to know the time. Pretty much. So what is lensing? So lensing is NGR, in general relativity. Space-time gets to be distorted, and then light ray goes into curves. And so if you have a massive object, the objects, and you're looking at something behind this, say, this planet or this sun here, it will be shifted. So here we have a very big object. We have Abel, for example, which is a huge galaxy cluster. And we're looking, is there something behind us? Now, the universe is very empty, turns out. It's huge. And so it doesn't happen all the time that there is something just behind the thing you're looking at. But sometimes it does happen that there is something behind. And then when it does, you're really happy because then you're going to have some lensing event. And the lensing, what's great about it is that by looking at this guy here, you can figure out what the mass of this object is. So you can measure the mass of that. So this is why we use gravitational lensing. And this Abel cluster is the most famous object for lensing. It's close by. It's huge. It's the biggest thing in the universe. And there's tons of stuff behind this guy. So there's a lot of lensing going on here. There's a lot of things which are being lensed. Now, unfortunately, I'm not an observational person. I was trying to say, oh, this is a lensing event. This is a lensing event. So I couldn't tell by eye. So I went to a paper, and it turns out like it's really tricky. These guys like are saying, this is a figure. It's really hard. You know, a lot of physicists do really hard stuff, harder than I do. Turns out like C1, C2, and C4 are a triple image. These are like three little dots in the previous picture, but I don't even know where they are. And these are a lens image. Anyway, so they go really hard. And you'd think that these were three different galaxies. It turns out they are the same galaxy that's being lensed. And because of that, the lensing, they're able to figure out the mass of the cluster. This is called strong gravitational lensing, and it's cool, but we can do even better than that. And this is sort of the forefront of what people are doing now. It's called weak gravitational lensing. And the idea there is that instead of looking at something that's behind, you just look at the galaxies. It turns out the galaxies are not point-like source. They have some shape. And so when imagine putting all these galaxies inside of water, essentially, and then all the light rays get distorted because of the water waves. So this is the idea. You put this guy into some mass distribution of dark matter, then all the galaxy gets distorted a little bit because the light rays moved here and there and blah, blah, blah. So there's everything will be distorted. So if you have a computer that's powerful enough and you work out these somewhat complicated equations a little bit for this one, it's a bit messy, but you can really work out exactly where all the mass is. And so people are doing this. And for example, this is another cluster called Abel 1620 or something. And all the white, this is fake color. Okay, this is where the dark matter is. And we reconstructed this by doing weak gravitational lensing. So we're able to just like put all the, really map out the dark matter. So this is getting very impressive, and this is going on, and people are trying to map out all the dark matter in the universe, and so have a map, So it's pretty nice, yeah. So and this is just going to get better and better as it moves on. Okay, so now, has anybody have heard about the Bullet Cluster? Is that getting to the point where, no? So this is you made the news. It's the reason why I think modifying gravity is essentially ruled out as an explanation for dark matter. It's a very nice cluster. So this is what it looks like. So if you're an astronomer, I guess you would say, oh, right away, this is two clusters, not one. There's one here and there's one here. But not very obvious. Let's look at it in the X-ray gas. It's a little easier. So when you look at the X-ray gas, you find something quite amazing. They're like shock waves. So there's the gas, so and it looks like there's a big, so there's a big bump, but there's like shock waves. So here you see the bulk clusters is two clusters that collided. And the galaxies are just point-like, so they just went to each other, doing nothing. But the gas itself interacted, the intergalactic gas, and you got the shock wave. Now the thing that's amazing is we could look where do the gravitational lensing stuff to figure out where the dark matter is. And the dark matter is clearly separated. You have one cluster here, and then there are galaxies in there. And again, the dark matter is the main thing. Really, galaxies can be neglected. This is 85% of the mass is these blobs. And then when you put everything together, you see that the dark matter is separated from the gas. So this is like the best proof we have that dark matter exists. What we saw is two clusters that collided. The galaxies went past each other. They didn't, you know, their points. The dark matter doesn't interact. So the dark matter just passed by each other without doing anything. But the gas of normal matter, this is hydrogen and helium, the gas of normal matter interacted and it was stuck in between. So this is the best evidence we have dark matter because this is the only picture we have where it's clear that the dark matter and the matter are not on top of each other. So we can really tell that there's a difference. Okay? So, all right, now let's do cosmology. So we have these objects. They're made mostly of dark matter, and 15% of it is matter. And we want to understand where they come from. And so the first approximation is to forget about the matter. Forget about everything we're made of. Just look at the dark matter. Okay, so we're going to get the answer wrong by 15%, but, you know, that's just first approximation. So let's forget about all the matter. Let's just do dark matter. This is in this Lambda CDM model, CDM here, it stands for cold dark matter. So this is, we're just going to suppose that the universe is made only of cold dark matter. And we're going to take it to be a particle with no interaction and with a mass. And then the idea is, can we take our universe, evolve it, and create these big objects? Okay. So clearly we need some original seeds. We need some original perturbation. If the universe is completely smooth to start with, it's going to stay smooth forever. So we need some initial perturbation. And this is my research is mostly about these initial perturbations. That's all I like to base it. This is a big mystery. What are they? But let's start by putting, yeah, so let's what we need here is here's our model for universe. Our universe is made just of dark matter. Dark matter is the simplest thing in the world. It's a particle with mass m that doesn't interact with anything except gravity. The only thing it does is it gravitates. It will fall into gravitational field. It will fall into gravitational well. Then the only force we need is gravity. And we can even use Newton's theory. Turns out that that's good enough often for these things. And then we need some spectrum of perturbation. We don't even need to put the expansion, right? The expansion is automatic. Because the theory of Einstein always lead to expansion of the universe. And then you just put that all and you do what we call an n-body simulation, because we were going to put n particle, and you just let it go and see whether it gives our universe. This is like the simplest model, and it's incredible how much it works. Okay, let me show you. This is a simulation by done in University of Chicago. So put a big box. This is our universe. It's expanding. Put in it n particle of dark matter, completely smooth. It's a gas of dark matter, completely smooth, nothing in it. Put some small initial perturbations. Now, what's going to happen is if you have perturbations, the dark matter is going to fall in the perturbations. And then the perturbations are going to grow. The perturbation, you should think of, like, put perturbation in the space-time. You know how gravity bends, mass bends the space-time. So imagine that the space-time has some small perturbation on it. So the dark matter is going to fall in. And then it's going to make the hole bigger and bigger. So it's just going to clump. Gravity is going to make this thing clump by itself. As long as it's not exactly smooth, if you start it, it's going to clump. And so you put some perturbation in it, and you let it go. And indeed, it clumps. And it forms filaments. You have a bunch of small lumps here, and then you have bigger lumps. These would be our clusters. These are intersection of the filaments, or like they're called often supercluster, but they're not bound objects. So that's why I don't talk. Clusters are really objects. These are just the corner of filaments. So, but you get this filament structure, and then you look at the data. Well, so again, this is a movie. Redshift, you evolve, and you get the all this different universe. And if you look at the data, and you put, this is the data that we took, with the scale. This is a Sloan Digital Sky Survey, and each of these dots is a galaxy, not a cluster. It's just this is a galaxy. You see that it looks very similar just by eye. You can tell that there are the filament structure, and it's not, it's almost smooth. The universe is almost smooth, but not quite. So it seems the universe is, in fact, one of the simplest possible thing in the world, just a gas of particle that collapse and clump together. So we can do, what we could do also is we could look at these galaxies, and we can measure. These are like a small perturbations on top of this. We can do a decomposition into harmonics. Whenever you have a feel, essentially, you can do a decomposition in harmonics, just like you have your clarinet. You're playing a note. You can decompose into harmonics. Then we can do the same thing for the universe. And some people figure out what the sound of dark matter is. So this is the sound of the universe. This is when you decompose the universe perturbation into harmonics. It's a very nice sound. It's mostly white noise. Obviously, you have a clarinet. You have all these notes you hit. The universe, when you look at it, what does it look when you decompose it into harmonics? It's a very white noise, just a nice big bump here. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to understand where does this thing come from? Why do we have the galaxies? Why does it have the structure like this? Okay. Oh, and let me show you actually, I'll show you another simulation. Oops. Let's not put the sound first. So the simulation I showed you was from Chicago. It's kind of a smallish one. We've been doing a lot bigger. So this is a simulation they did at the Max Planck Institute in Germany. It's a simulation purely dark matter, clumping by itself with a set of initial perturbation. And we're going to start at a redshift of 50, which is, okay, so this is model independent. This is assuming lambda CDM. We convert it into years. So this is 0.06 giga year after the Big Bang. We have a gas of dark matter with some small perturbation, and the color means that it's getting denser. So let's run it. Why is that? So this scale here is 500 kiloparsec. This is actually, this is 500 kiloparsec. This is not a galaxy cluster, this is just a galaxy halo. So this is the dark matter around a galaxy. And they took the camera and they just turn around, okay? But they're always pointing at the center of the halo. And so you see this filament structure. You see all the clumping of the dark matter. Whenever it gets yellow, you get more and more dense. And at a redshift of 7 or 8, when it's coming soon, you're going to notice that an object really clearly appears. This is when essentially the galaxy was formed for the first time. You see, there it goes. So here, now you really get a halo, of a galactical halo. This is all dark matter. There was a question? Yeah, no, this simulation is amazing. And it keeps growing. Redshift, now you see the years is going, redshift goes down really fast and the years is constant. Just keeps going in. It's also the clumping. What's happening in our universe is the small structure form first, and then they merge. It's not a fragmentation process. It's a merging process. So you see all these merging things. So it just keeps growing and growing. And now we're about 5 giga year. So soon our sun is going to be created. Our sun is 5 billion years old, and so about 8 billion years old after the Big Bang. So now we had probably the second generation of galaxies, and soon the third generation of galaxy will be created, the third generation of stars. So yeah, it's just amazing. And this is just dark matter. And this is 500 kiloparsecs, so the galaxy that we see is like this big. And this is all the dark matter that surrounds it. Yeah, I should maybe, I always wonder where I should leave. You can find this on YouTube. Let me stop it. Just keeps on going. They have like, let me just play you a little bit. They have a music that goes with it. And so you just watch the universe being created. You can watch this movie like every 2 minutes. Yeah, let me watch it again. It just goes on forever. And then they have a great part, which is here, let's say. They say this is just a simulation. Anyway. Which it is just a simulation. This is just a simulation. Anyway, so yeah, it's great fun to look at the universe being created like this. Oops. Let's look at the sound. So the thing that it works perfectly, but they had to input something. It looks too easy, right? Just put this in there and then just run the computer and oh, we have our universe. There was a hidden assumption there, is that the perturbations that we put were very special. They're very special type of perturbations, and they're very strange. And this is the question right now, one of the questions we're trying to understand. So what they put is a spectrum of perturbation. So this is the initial thing you need to put in, and then you let it evolve, and it gives us our universe. But these perturbations, the question is, where did they come from? And why are they this way? And, well, what way are they? Well, these are perturbation in the gravitational potential. And the idea is we have perturbation on all wavelength. So there's a perturbation, like it's like in this room, I say, the gravitational field is a little bit stronger on the right than on the left. And so if I create this perturbation, the molecule of air will want to go there. But I can put other perturbations also on smaller wavelength, on smaller scale. So what we see is we need, to get our universe right, we need to put a perturbation on every wavelength, and each perturbation has the same amplitude. This is what we call scale invariance. So if I write the power for a perturbation as a function of the wave number, just 1 over the wavelength, this is in megaparsec because that's the size of the universe, it's exactly the same power for each wavelength. So that's just, if that's what we put in, then it works. Another thing, so right now I don't have any explanation, I'm just telling you that this is, you put that in and then the simulation works. The other thing is that we create this perturbation in advance. They've been laid down, they've been created, they're all there, and we discover them. What happens is our universe expands. So imagine this is our universe. And when our universe expands, so at the beginning our universe is small, and these particles of dark matter don't know they can fall there because they're just, the universe is here. But then the universe expands, and as it expands, suddenly the dark matter realize, oh, look, I'm supposed to go here. And these guys realize they're supposed to go there. And so they start falling into these well. Okay. And as it expands, you see more and more. So it's like all these perturbations were created and were just laid down there. And the universe expands and we just discover them. Just realize that suddenly the dark matter realize that it's supposed to go to the left of the universe. Okay. So there are, you know, there are large scale perturbations here that all the galaxy cluster want to move in some direction or another. And and this works great. So what happens is that the dark matter falls in, and then because of normal clumping, just as more dark matter falls in, the perturbation grows. So it's a self-reinforcing process. When dark matter falls in, more of it wants to fall in, blah, blah, blah. We find that this basic line here will grow. Okay? And what the thing happens is that you can see that in this process, the small wavelength have entered first in the universe, if you wish, enter, versus the long wavelength are the last one to enter. And so the small wavelength perturbation will grow for longer because they've entered, they've been acting for longer. And so what this means is mean that this bar here goes from flat to up. Is that clear? A bit fast. So that means that the basic things we should expect if we measure the power spectrum, so the sound of the universe, is we should expect a line that's going like this. Okay, and forget about the red line for the moment. CDM is the model I'm considering. So cold dark matter, so it's a line that's going like this, and this is small scale. So we should have more power, more objects on small scale than on big scale. It's also the reason why galaxy clusters were created later, because the big perturbations came in our universe later. So the first thing you create is small little lump of dark matter, and then you create bigger and bigger objects. Yeah, and so this is essentially what we see, except that it goes back down. And this is a little trickier to understand just in our model, because you need to have more than just dark matter to explain this. Now I have to use the fact that early on the universe was actually full of photon, not dark matter. So you need to improve a little bit. But we get this part right, and then it goes back down. And the reason it goes back down is because the universe, when it was early on, was actually made of mostly full of photons and radiation. Questions? Yes.
Early on, are you talking about the first few seconds or?
Yeah. Yeah, I'm getting there. Yeah. Yeah, no, right now it's the late. I'm looking at the universe today. This is all today, essentially. This is measured today. I mean, we're looking, this creation process is like the simulation. So redshift 40, so that means about 0.06 billion years after the Big Bang. So this is all late. But the beauty is that in order to understand this late universe, we're going to have to go back to 10 to minus 43. And this is because, and this is the twist in the story, if you wish. Questions?
I heard something that there are some new evidences that the universe is flat.
Yes, the universe is flat.
Mm-hmm. It's flat?
Yeah, that's a very, it's flat to one part in 10, I mean, you can quantify exactly how flat. So, yeah, what I'm saying here is that it's flat, but there's a small perturbations on top of it. But the overall geometry, if I average out, it's completely flat. And we know this because we're measuring essentially big triangles in the universe, and we measure the angle, and they add up to 180. So if it was a sphere, the angles would not add up.
Doesn't that go against the Einstein theory?
No, Einstein will allow for flat curve. It's a puzzle. It is a puzzle why the universe is flat. It's not a stable point. And you think that if the universe is flat, the matter will make it normally curve. And so it's somewhat of a puzzle. And actually, the theory I will present a little later on is actually explain why the universe is flat. But yeah, these, and again, I really cannot overemphasize that 30 years ago, these questions could only have been answered by speculative, oh, I think it's flat, or I'm not sure, or maybe, maybe not. And now we have to the point where we have really precise data. So I can tell you how much it's flat and to what precision it's flat. And, you know, and the age of the universe is 13.72 billion years old. You know, it's very precise now. It's pretty amazing.
So this is due to the satellites? That
yeah, that's right. Hubble. These X-ray satellites, WMAP and Planck, which I'm not talking about, but the one that measure cosmic microwave background. Yes, there's just been tons and tons of data. So you have now mounting evidence all pointing towards the same, the same theory and the same facts. So at some point, I mean, it's just like you can always doubt, and this is good in science, you know, you should always, this lambda CDM model, so right now I mostly just describe the cold dark matter part. But so this model we call lambda CDM, it still may be wrong or maybe not quite right. But they're really getting to the point where we have a lot of evidence right now. So just like for the age of the Earth, at some point you just start believing it. You know, okay, the age of the Earth is that much, which I don't remember. The age of the Sun is 5 billion, I think. Okay, so what do we have? Let me summarize. We have what we can explain the large scale structure of the universe using dark matter.
we need radiation at the beginning, but I, you know, on time, I'm not going to explain why this goes back down. But we can explain this data we see, and these, the line is the prediction from the theory, I should say, and these dots are different experiments. And the fact that we have a lot of experiments, this is cosmic microwave background, this is WMAP and Planck. SDSS, this is the Sloan Digital Sky Survey. Cluster abundance, this is looking at galaxy clusters, which is what the thing I've been talking about. Weak lensing is a weak gravitational lensing. You know, this is just a list of things we're doing. It's nonstop. And they all point towards a model, and we understand this curve. It works as long as also you have some initial perturbation, which are scale invariant. They're Gaussian. I'm not explaining this, but the statistics are Gaussian, it turns out. And they're frozen in the sense that they're created and they just stay there. They don't do anything. We just discover them as we expand. It's like they've been created before us, I don't know what, and we just discover them. So this model works great. It fails on very small distances, but that's normal. We neglected baryons. We neglected hydrogen. So this is work in progress. Don't worry about it. This is the 15%. It's really hard to take the simulation that you see and then put hydrogen and helium in there. Because if you put hydrogen and helium, then you need to include magnetic field, you need to include dissipation. This is a messy physics. So we don't, so it's much harder. So the simulation don't include galaxies, but still. It also fails recently. It doesn't quite get the right answer recently, and this is because recently the universe started to have dark energy, and right now in the simulation, it did not put dark energy. This is the lambda and lambda CDM. This was the Nobel Prize of Physics this year. The discovery that the universe accelerated. This was the discovery was done in 98. This is somewhat more of a mystery. I mean, we know there's a lot of theories of physics that explain that that gets dark energy. But the real mystery is why is there so little dark energy? So the problem is not why there's dark energy. The problem is why there's so little of it. But there is still enough of it that today this is the dominant source of energy in the universe. So again, like because of time, I'm not, and because also because of time, and also because we don't have as much understanding, I'm not going to talk much more about this. Let's try instead to understand why this is a I found the, one of the weird part. Where did these perturbations come from? Yeah, why? Why do we have Gaussian initial condition? Why are these scale invariant? Why are they frozen? Frozen super horizon mean outside of our universe. Okay. Well, there's one theory which is proposed. This is speculative. Now, up to now, I consider lambda CDM to be a well-established theory, which could be wrong, but it's, you know, it's well-established. Like many other well-established theories, that doesn't mean it's right, but it has a lot of evidence for it. This one, we have a lot less evidence, and this is where you get to these 10 to the minus 40 seconds after Big Bang. So the idea of inflation and how it gives you the universe we see is pretty beautiful. So we're going to assume that there's an era of dark energy. Now, you could say this is a really bad starting point for a theory, since we don't understand what dark energy is. So this is, but whatever. Inflation starts with the dark energy, but not right now. It's back in the early universe. So we're going to start with dark energy. When you have a universe which is made of dark energy, it accelerates. Okay, this is the Nobel Prize of Physics was the fact that we discovered that the universe is accelerating. This is what dark energy does. Dark energy is like anti-gravity. So it pushes things apart and make the universe expand faster. Normally, you think, normal physics, you think if I have a universe that's expanding and it's made of matter, because of matter clumps, it should slow down the expansion. You know, that's what we expected. But in 1998, people discovered that the universe is not slowing down, it's actually speeding up. And the only way you can explain that is if you have some kind of anti-gravity, if you want, some dark energy which is pushes things. But since we have observed this, so it's not that crazy. I mean, we've seen it, so let's use it. Let's assume that we had such an era in the early universe. Then the magic that happens if you have a dark energy in the early universe, small quantum fluctuations in this dark energy era are amplified. And their wavelength gets stretched because the universe accelerates super fast. I'll show you my own made little movie about this. But it's going to become clearer. This is the important point. The small quantum fluctuations amplify. And then the idea is that these small quantum fluctuations are the one that are the original perturbation that the simulation people were using. So the theory, this is a theory which explains the perturbations, which before we just had to put by hand. We just say we can explain the universe if I put by hand these perturbations. Now, if you assume inflation, you can create these perturbations with just the right properties. And the only thing you need to use is the fact that the world is quantum. So here, it's much nicer explanation. You've improved because you're not putting it by hand. You're saying, let's assume that there's dark energy. Let's use the fact that the world is quantum and there are quantum fluctuations. And then, poof, you get the right answer. Sort of. So let me, yeah. Let me explain a little bit the story. So start with a smooth, the universe now in this picture. Again, this is now more speculative. We're trying to test this theory right now. So if we accept on the CDM, this is the next thing to test, if you want. So we start with a small, the universe starts really small. Okay. 10 minus, you know, this is the distance, very small object. And it's smooth and it's just dark energy. Completely smooth. So this is my initial conditions. This is how I need to, you're doing cosmology, you cannot avoid it. You have to have some initial condition. So here's the initial condition. I say this is the, I get the universe. All right, what happens? Well, because of dark energy, it accelerates super fast. So it inflates. This is where the name comes from, inflation. It just gets super fast. Now, so fast that everything that's in there would go outside of our horizon. Our horizon is the thing that we can affect, the thing that we can see. So things are sort of leaving our horizon. This is the universe we see. This is what we call the observable universe. So this is our horizon. Anything outside that circle is unobservable. So what this does is it makes the universe super big. And we live only on a small part of that universe. This is why the universe is flat. Or this theory explains why the universe is flat, because even if it was curved at the beginning, it becomes so big that we only live on a small part of it. The same way we think the Earth is flat, because we are small and the Earth is not flat, but if you just look around, it looks flat. So this is the same explanation of why the universe is flat. The universe is flat because it's a small part of something bigger. So the bigger, we don't know. Maybe it's a sphere, maybe it's not, maybe it's a saddle, but it's big. And so we see only a small part of it, if this theory is right. And then, okay, then the universe is completely filled with dark energy everywhere. And we live there. And then what happens is some of these quantum fluctuations, they're perturbation of the metric. And they amplify, they grow. So you get these small perturbation, and they grow. And because of it, the expansion of the universe, the wavelength gets longer. The amplitude stays the same, but the wavelength just keeps being stretched. And so you create these perturbations. They're all nicely created. They all have the same amplitude. They just have all different wavelengths. So you create, and you just keep creating them. And this just happens naturally. It's just quantum physics. Okay. This is a very small universe, of course. And then what happens is inflation ends, so the dark energy suddenly disappear. So we have models for that, but all the energies is dumped into radiation. So now we have a plasma made. This is really what I would call the Big Bang, really. Then suddenly you have a fireball. You have a universe which is made of hot plasma of photons and electrons and quarks and whatever. But then what happens is now you're doing a normal expansion. Now you're no longer accelerating. You're doing the normal expansion, the universe expands normally. And so the horizon starts growing, if you wish. Things are coming back in. Things that you couldn't see, now suddenly you're catching up to them because the universe is no longer accelerating. It's like right now the universe is accelerating, so there's stuff which is going away from us and they're going away faster and faster. If these keep up, we're never going to see these objects. We're never going to be able to get to some. Their galaxy clusters are too far. If the universe keeps accelerating forever, we'll never get to them. But if it stops accelerating, then maybe they'll come back and we can go talk to them one day. So this is what's happening. The universe stops accelerating, and then we're going back and we're discovering these perturbations. And so, and then dark matter, then the story that I said before goes in. Dark matter discovers or sees these perturbations and it falls in. And then you get structure. So this is one story. I mean, the dark matter story is well understood. The inflation just provides you the perturbations naturally. So the question. And so the statement, and this is a sort of cool part of it, is that everything we see really originated, these perturbations originated from quantum physics. Very small little quantum physics gives you the biggest thing in the universe, the galaxy cluster. It's kind of mind-blowing. Yeah, it would be cool if it was true. Again, we're testing it. And the thing is that it's testable because we can use data to figure out exactly what the perturbations needs to be, what the properties of all these wavelengths needs to be. And inflation, well, it will predict a specific form for these perturbations, so you can just compare. Unfortunately, we don't have that much handhold. We don't have that much way of testing it. So it's not like the age of the universe or the dark matter. We don't have that many ways to test this theory. So, but you know, it's something for the future. Maybe we'll find ways. All right. So let me finish. First thing is the biggest things are really big, okay, as all know, okay, somewhat of a mystery also. Why is the universe so big, right? Why this is also, it doesn't have, why is there billions and billions of galaxies? Why are there billions and billions, you know, galaxy clusters? It's just like, it seems so superfluous. It seems so unnecessary if you just, you know, say it's somewhat of a waste of space sometimes. Anyway, so but the biggest things are really big, and there they are, really big stuff. But yeah, don't worry, we have a theory, and it works great. There it is. It's called Lambda CDM, and it's great because it works, but it's also great because we have way of testing it, and therefore it could be wrong, and we could tell if it was wrong. So this is the state of the art, if you want. Now this is the Lambda CDM model. And now we put inflation on top of it. We can even explain the perturbations. Okay. So, thank you.